Hi, this is Emily Walker, the Vice President of Advocacy here at the Society, and I'm here today with Walter Stosch, one of our members and the esteemed former state senator. And now that our tax conformity white paper has been out for a little while and we've gotten some questions, we just wanted to take a little bit of time to provide some additional information and explanation as to how we arrived at the positions that we did with the paper. So, as I'm sure you know, we really are focused mostly on getting complete conformity, at least to the extent that Virginia can. And one of the biggest questions that I've heard is, why are we not making more recommendations on the policy front in terms of changes to Virginia's tax code to kind of mitigate the impact that the federal reforms are having on us? But also, why are we recommending this idea of sequestering the extra revenue in the first year and delaying any reforms until 2019? So I wanted to get Walter's perspective on that.
Well, traditionally, in fact, when I was in the Senate and chaired the Finance Committee, I was always the chief patron of the conformity bill, and the goal was to try to introduce the conformity bill as early as possible in the session so that it can be passed quickly and sent to the governor for his signature, and that was the process we followed, and it worked very well. That allowed our practitioners and the taxpayers to know early in the year what the rules were so that they could file their tax returns. The complexity of that is that it requires something called an emergency clause, and an emergency clause on a bill basically says it's in effect when the governor signs it, not the following July.
Right.
So as a practical matter, rather than that bill being effective July following the session in which it was debated, the emergency clause was placed on it to expedite it. There is a requirement that is not well known on the emergency clause. It requires an 80% vote in both houses of the House and Senate.
Right, that's a challenge.
and generally, that's not a problem. You know, people want to go back home and say, I did everything I could to make sure you could file your tax returns on time and you knew what the rules were. There has been some discussion in this particular session, given the nature of all the changes in the federal code, and since there will be new revenues generated to the state, that some of the legislators would like to have a combined bill that carries out their goals of tax reform as well as tax conformity. Those are two different issues, conformity and reform. That would normally work as well, provided that anyone's idea is so strong that they can gain an 80% majority vote. And the speculation is that no one has a solution that will gain an 80% vote. So the Society's objective is not to tell the legislators what to do, but on behalf of our practitioners and on behalf of our taxpayers, we certainly do not want to wait until July or even worse, October, to know what the rules are for the 2018 tax returns. So that's the reason the Society, as you know, because you've been in the forefront, has taken the position that we would like for conformity to be a separate bill, gaining the 80% vote because it's a logical thing to do. And then any policy decisions that the members wish to advance, they can do that separately, separate bills, as many as they want to, subject to the limits of bills of each house. In 1986, when we were faced with a similar situation of tax reform, lowering federal taxes but raising state income, we were uncertain as to the amount of revenue that would be generated from those changes because of the timing, because of the rules. In this case, the rules have still not yet been defined. They're evolving each day. We came up with an idea that whatever funds were generated would be placed into a fund. In that case, we used three different funds. But the concept is trying to estimate the revenue after the fact, place it into a fund, and then the policy changes could use that fund to return them to the taxpayers or do whatever they wanted to do. In 1986, as I recall, we ended up changing the standard deduction amount instead of the state return. We changed the tax brackets.
Right.
And in one case, in order to, because of uncertainty of the amount, there was actually a one-time credit issued to each taxpayer. So there are lots of options and lots of choices that the legislators have, and we, as a society, we've encouraged them to address them in whatever fashion they feel best, but do so as separate undertakings so that our taxpayers can have an orderly understanding of the rules and a time in which to prepare their tax returns.
Right. So as we talked about, this is really, it really comes back to timing being the key issue. And, you know, if we don't proceed with tax conformity, then we create a really messy tax season with a lot of adjustments for both individual and corporate taxpayers. And we've seen other states where this has happened, and they've really created a big mess. And because we haven't made these decisions yet, and January 2019 is looming, which will be the start of tax season for 2018 returns, the programming isn't in place for the software vendors or even for the tax department itself to be able to start processing returns. So we need a quick decision so that they can get all the programming up to date as quickly as possible. And conformity is certainly the simplest way to do that because that involves the least amount of new programming that would have to occur.
Well, we are naturally concerned about our constituents, our members and also their clients, but think in terms of the thousands of individuals who try to file their own tax return.
Right.
And the complexity they will have. And so it's just not, it's an issue of how can we make it as, how can we take advantage of the federal changes, many of which were positive, and at the same time not place a filing and compliance burden on the taxpayers.
Right. Now, I know I've talked to a lot of members over the past year since we've been trying to deal with implementing the federal tax law, and initially there were hopes that we would have a special session at some point during 2018 to be able to deal with this before 2019 session happened, and that hasn't occurred. And I think that has changed the conversation as well, and that's where we started to look at this idea of creating special funds, but also the recommendation that any policy changes that our legislators do decide to move forward with and can get a vote to approve those, that those wouldn't take effect until the 2019 filing year because we're concerned about disruption to the filing season.
Well, not only that, but think of the Commonwealth as a whole, for example. If the tax returns for 2018 are not filed until after July 1st, which would be the effective date of a non-emergency clause bill, many of your taxpayers will file for extensions, which means the tax returns for 2018 will not be filed until October of 2018. That will have a significant adverse impact on the cash flow to the Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not only the effect on the taxpayers, but there's effect on just the sheer complexity of the timing of tax receipts.
Right.
That's an issue. So you really will not know the amounts of the impact of the federal tax changes on the state income tax until well into 2019. That argues in favor of creating a fund so that you can identify the amounts when and as determined, and then any policy changes would be effective January 1 of 19, so that you would not have to go back and retroactively do something.
Right.
So I don't know that our members are as concerned about the timing for any other reason, but simply the not having to go back and change your computer programs and all the other things you need to do until July or August or September, it would be, I'll say, a nightmare.
Right. So I guess another question that has popped up is, you know, whether or not us not advocating for earlier policy changes makes creates the perspective that the society is okay with tax increases that are occurring as a result of the federal changes. And I think I would argue that that's not the case. We are encouraging the legislators to move forward with trying to find some policy reforms to kind of reset the playing field for Virginia taxpayers, but that we're just really looking at it from a practical standpoint, but also understanding the politics that are at play and are going to influence how quickly legislation may move during the upcoming session.
Well, think about the alternatives that will be facing the legislators. To do nothing, in other words, not to conform to the federal rules, means that we are conforming as of February 2018, whatever the rules were then, mm-hmm. but the rules we would follow, which means that we would not be picking up most of these changes. But politically, to do nothing still generates the revenue to the Commonwealth. So if there's concern about an inadvertent anything related to a tax increase, that would be a tax increase by inaction.
Right.
And the result would be that then the administration would decide on how those funds were spent, because they would just flow into the general revenue. So that's probably not a good option when they think it through, and I'm sure they are aware of that. Second option would be total conformity. There's enough revenue being generated, I believe, to the Commonwealth to allow us to take that step, so that all of these little differences that require taxpayers to keep two sets of books or two sets of records could be reconciled using this opportunity. So total conformity would be a great goal.
Right, absolutely.
And that would mean we'd get rid of some of these things like the depreciation differences and that sort of thing. So I'm hoping that our legislators will recognize that even in a conformity bill where they create the fund, they could still say the fund is to be created to be used for tax equity or tax reform or whatever they wish to do,
right,
to send a signal to the to anyone who was concerned that this fund is to be used for reform.
Not just to spend.
Now, spending may, I've heard some say, well, this is an opportunity to build our reserves.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard others say we ought to give it back to the people who pay it. And then there are others that are somewhere in between. That's the reason that we had the fear, as you know, that we could not get an 80% agreement, because there's
right.
so many different ideas.
There are. There's a ton of ideas. And they do range. They everything from give it all back to keep it all, and everything in between. And even I think within each of the caucuses, there's not consensus yet. So trying to build beyond that 50% to an 80% is going to be particularly challenging. So
we know by analysis from the estimates of the Chambers report which income groups the new taxes are coming from, but it's just an estimate. I mean, we're not really
right.
sure yet until we have a time to measure.
That's true as well, and it's a point that we've been making as we've met with some of the policymakers in Virginia, is that right now these are all estimates, and they're based on a lot of assumptions that include certain taxpayer behavior, which in some cases may or may not play out the way that a software program has picked it up. So we're very uncertain as to the actual revenue impact.
Well, back to your question on the policy changes, I think if we understood what the goals were,
mm-hmm.
it would be much easier for our members to weigh in. For example, step number one is figure out how much new revenue is coming in.
Right.
Step number two is where is it coming from? What's causing that? And as you say, you really do not know until the taxpayers react to it and figure out what's the best position for them to be in. And then thirdly, what is the best way to return all or part of that to the taxpayers? And think of the choices you've got. We do not conform on the itemized deductions, except that if you itemize on one, you have to do the other.
Mm-hmm.
We do not conform on exemptions, so they could change the exemption allowance. We do not conform on the rates. So if like in 86, that's a possibility. So I'm not sure until we know what their overall policy goals are, it would be appropriate for us to weigh in as members.
Right.
As much as all of us might like to.
Right. Well, I guess the other thing I would say there, though, is because it's part of the society's role to be nonpartisan and more of an advisory capacity and things like this, but that certainly doesn't preclude individual members who have ideas from reaching out to their legislators and sharing those. And we would encourage that, I think.
Indeed, in the meetings we've had with the legislators, we pointed that out. We're not trying to limit the number of policy recommendations or bills, nor are we trying to influence the ultimate outcome. Because the first step is to find what do you want these policy goals to achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Some would say the governor has a plan that would weight any equity towards very low-income families, which is worthy of consideration. Others are saying it's the middle-income people who are being hurt the most, so we should do something there. I think the statistics will show much of the new income is coming from people who are in the upper-income brackets, because they're the ones who tend to itemize their tax returns, and it's the loss of itemized deductions at the federal that's
right.
causing and generating most of the revenue to the state.
Right.
So, you know, I think the legislators are quite capable of sorting all that out and coming up with policy decisions. And our role, in my view, is to support what they do and make sure it works.
Right. Make sure it's administrable and as streamlined as possible, but let them come to those conclusions on their goals.
Sure. I doubt if our members could agree on what the policy should be.
And I would agree with you on that,
right.
because I've heard from a lot of members over the course of this past year, and the recommendations really run the gamut. I've heard quite a few who are very committed to the idea of allowing itemization, even if you take the standard deduction on the federal return. There's many who say just increase the standard deduction. I've talked with others about changing the rates or the brackets or increasing the personal exemption. And that's just on the individual side. So there's a lot of ideas.
Each of those has a great deal of merit, but they do affect taxpayers differently.
Right.
So that is the decision that only the policymakers can make.
Right. We really
right.
didn't feel like that was our role to
right.
to tell them how to do that
exactly.
or who they should be helping
exactly.
the most. So,
well, the itemized deduction, there is a bill already in that sort of overcomes the requirement that if you itemize on the federal, you must itemize on the state. This would say you could do it either way.
Mm-hmm.
And that has merit. I mean, but again, that's a policy decision that will return those funds to a particular targeted group of taxpayers, whereas
right.
something else may be totally different.
Exactly. So we just kind of need to wait and see how that plays out, and hopefully they can find a way to reach consensus
right.
of some kind to move forward with some
sure.
changes.
Well, we may be able to talk about fairness and equity and things like that, but the actual details are too complex for us to, I think, to reach a consensus on among our members, just like they're too complex for the legislators at this point to have reached a consensus.
Exactly.
So I think my recommendation to our members would be to make sure they make themselves available to their local delegate and senator in case they have questions of compliance or how does this work or what's the impact of this or that or the other, so that we become a source of help to them as they go through this process.
I completely agree. So I'm glad we're on the same page about that. So I think one other thing just to mention briefly before we close this out, the Wayfair case. You know, there's been a little bit of conversation churning about that and how does that play into this overall reform conversation as well. So it's not really related to conformity, but it is a piece of the equation and a potential revenue source for the state.
Well, many of your retailers, particularly the smaller ones, have complained for years that it's unfair that they have to collect sales taxes from their customers, whereas if that same customer orders it online, they do not have to collect the tax. That should be equality because we have a sales and use tax in Virginia, so if you do not pay it at the source, you're supposed to add it back to your tax return. It's a little bit like years ago, we had a personal property tax form in RICO, and you're supposed to report all your furniture and your tractors and your cattle and your watches and whatever. And I think I determined that only two of us had had watches. So there's not a lot of compliance on the use right. side. So there'll be, even though the law requires everybody to pay the same amount of tax when they buy something, it's not being complied with. So this Wayfair decision will say that the internet and the out-of-town, out-of-state vendors will have to collect the tax. So that's going to generate more revenue to Virginia, not by changing the law,
right.
but by changing the compliance. So it makes it arguably a fairer system for the so-called mom and pop for smaller people. It's not going to have as much of an impact on Virginia as it will in many other states, because one of the requirements for the internet products to be taxed is whether or not they have something called Nexus. Mm-hmm. And Amazon has Nexus in Virginia because they have all these distribution centers. So Amazon is already collecting the tax.
Right.
So it's not like all of a sudden you got all these internet sales and we're going to generate. But it will generate some new revenue, and the question is, how is that going to be used? Now, that's not a case of returning it to the taxpayer. That's just a matter of compliance.
Right.
So I suspect they will use that as some way, to the extent it's new revenue, they'll use that to help supplement local schools or something of that nature.
Okay. And it's my understanding, though, too, Walter, that there probably needs to be some legislation around this. And there's sort of two different issues at play, right? So there's one, we need to establish what those thresholds are to require collection and remittance. And that could be, in some cases, states are adopting rules around volume of sales, and in others it's a dollar threshold in the sales. And then the other piece to it is, do we need to maybe unwind some of the language around the transportation bill from several years ago, which could, if we don't pull that money directly towards transportation and some other things, instead of giving the legislators the ability to determine how to use the money.
Well, having some threshold probably makes some sense, because you have a lot of small vendors who perhaps would have difficulty dealing with collecting sales tax and that sort of thing. So that may be a case where the cost of compliance exceeds the revenue generated, and the cost of compliance on the retailers would be out of proportion. The transportation bill, when it passed, I think it was in 2012, had a provision in it that referred to the federal, to the possibility of a federal change that would require all transactions to be taxed and the funds remitted to the state. So there was a provision in the transportation bill that said, if that passes, we will lower the sales tax that was then imposed on gasoline. I don't remember all the history, but that was the reason for it. So there's probably an obligation to go back and look at that.
My understanding that there are some, we've passed that trigger point where Congress would need to pass something, right. but there's maybe an argument to be made that it impacts the gas tax.
In fact, they don't unwind it. In fact, Congress didn't pass it. It was a court case. I'm not sure of all the details, but the theory was, if we had had full compliance on all of these sales that were not being reported, could have used those funds for that transportation initiative.
Right.
So there is a link, whether or not it's a required.
There's at least the perception of a link.
Yes.
That there may be some benefit to cleaning up that language and.
Exactly.
That way there's a little more control over how the funds would be utilized.
Well, on behalf of the taxpayers, it is difficult to keep a record of everything you buy online and ask the question, did I pay the tax on that or not?
Right.
And then come back and put it on your tax return. I while I, over the years of pen tax work, I no longer do, and my son, who's a CPA, does my return, I always tell him, add $100 or whatever it takes to make sure it's more than enough.
Right.
Because I don't want to be out of compliance. But it's not an easy thing to do to report what you think you bought on the internet.
Well, and I guess probably a lot of average consumers may not even understand which products might be exempt from sales tax, because we do have some exemptions.
Exactly.
So that just creates a lot of headaches. So, all right. Well, I think that we've covered pretty much everything we wanted to at this point. So thank you, Walter. And
glad to be part of it.
We will keep this format in mind as issues evolve over the next several months. Thanks to you for listening, and just if you'd like to get involved in any of our advocacy efforts, particularly as it relates to tax conformity and policy reforms, I encourage you to take advantage of our new voter voice tool, which will allow you to very easily email your legislators with your opinion as well as the society's position. You can find that at vscpa.com/votervoice. And just make yourselves available to your legislators in your area. They're probably going to have a lot of questions this year on the impact of various different things they're contemplating, and could really use the expertise of our CPAs.